press a button. And to welcome, for the first time, to this Many Rivers Forum, our Thursdays at Many Rivers series, Ruth Schwartz, the author of this book that she'll be talking, I believe, is going to be the main subject tonight, Soul on Earth, A Guide to Living and Loving Your Human Life. But as you may note here, there are a number of other books here, also by Ruth Schwartz, that you may wish to peruse on your way out. I'm given to understand that many of them are poetry. So anyway, Ruth will be talking about this book. She is has a PhD, has taught at six universities, the originator of heart-mind integration, a therapeutic approach, blending shamanism, hypnotherapy, and energy medicine. Please join me in welcoming Ruth Schwartz to Many Rivers Books.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to be in this beautiful store, this beautiful environment, and thank all of you for coming. It's so cool to have these kinds of gatherings where people can just show up for free on an evening and talk about ideas and consciousness and what really matters and what propels us and joy. And so I love to get to be part of that conversation. And I have a loose outline that I thought I would follow, but it's really what I want to do here is hear from all of you as much as you're interested in sharing about, you know, what brought you to this talk? What's kind of moving through you in your life right now in relation to, you know, the themes that I put out on the flyer of, you know, here we are on this really troubled planet, obviously, and yet we're all wanting to know how to live our own lives and how to follow the thread that brings joy and what that has to do with all of the mess that's happening everywhere else around us and maybe even within us. So those are kind of the themes, and I'll talk for a little while to give you some context, but then I would love to have, you know, sort of questions and conversation back and forth. It's really an amazing feeling to be here getting to talk about this book, because although I am a writer, and I've been a writer for a very long time, and as Rob mentioned, those other books, I have five books of poetry, and I have a memoir. But this book really came out of some life changes that there's a lot of different ways to describe where it came out of, but in one sense, it came out of some life changes that I began to make around 2003, when I had a tenure-track job teaching creative writing at Cal State Fresno, which, you know, if you know anything about being a writer, it's like that's a job everybody wants. And I was restless, and I didn't know what was next for me, but it just felt like that wasn't it. And so out of that restlessness, I was just kind of casting about, and I ended up, to my own great surprise, because it was not something that I had felt drawn to at all, studying with a teacher of shamanic work and energy medicine. And out of that, again, to my extreme surprise, several years down the line, I found myself having conversations with an inner teacher. And, you know, this is the phenomenon that's popularly called channeling. I was, you know, reluctant to call it that, because some of the channeled material that's out there I think is amazing, and a lot of it I think is, you know, the opposite of amazing. And so I wasn't sure that I wanted to sort of cast my lot there, and I, you know, went through all this stuff about, am I crazy? Are other people going to think I'm crazy? What is this? And then I realized, well, what did I think I was doing when I was writing poetry all those years? Mm. You know, where were those poems really coming from? I was somebody that had always written poetry to get in touch with a place in me that was wiser than my everyday self. You know, I always felt like my poems knew more than I did. And that's a common thing that a lot of poets will say, a lot of writers will say. And so gradually over time, I became more able to accept this phenomenon of getting to hear from and speak with this wise inner teacher. And it became kind of like any teacher-student relationship, except for the fact that this teacher is available to me 24/7 and charges nothing, which has some advantages. And so this book is really a co-authorship, and there are some parts that are specifically mine. I didn't want to make it a channeled book because I felt like there are enough of those out there already. I wanted to present myself as a very, you know, human person with plenty of foibles and flaws and confusions and childhood wounds and, you know, conflicts and ambivalences and all that stuff that I imagine most of you have as well. My interface with what, in my experience, was this level of wisdom that I could sense and feel and be very much affected by, and which wasn't me. I mean, it was me, but it wasn't me. It wasn't this me, and that's kind of how my guide says it. And you know, because I'm me, and I am a fairly left brain person, I'm fairly grounded and pragmatic, I was really relieved that my guide did not announce himself as one of the ascended masters or Michael or, you know, Uriel or, you know, whatever, Seth. You know, I mean, I think it's really cool, the people that channel those figures. I don't put that down at all. But my guide refused to give himself a name, and I kind of appreciated that because it helped me to be less skeptical. It was not, you know, this wasn't like a big hierarchy of, you know, hey, you know, I'm channeling somebody so important. And so what my guide calls himself, and he's not really a him, but just the energy sort of felt more male to me, he calls himself a voice of the six directions. And he was very specific that it was a voice, not the voice. And so I realized I had to figure out what this meant, the six directions. And as many of you probably know, throughout many, many different cultures, there has been a practice of honoring or celebrating or calling in the directions. Some cultures call in five, some call in seven, ten, or six. But as I understand it, what calling in the six directions is calling in all of the different principles in the universe. And so that's the place, according to this teacher that I work with, that this knowledge comes from. And so it's been incredibly transformative in my life, although I still am a human being with foibles and flaws and conflicts and all the rest. But it's been amazing to get to interface and converse back and forth with this level of wisdom. And the thing actually that's been the most reassuring to me that this phenomenon is real is that I can show up. You know, when I'm talking with him by myself, I usually have a piece of paper in front of me. I can show up and ask questions from this human level of consciousness. Like, usually it's like, well, what should I do? Should I do this or that? Or why is this happening? You know, and then these answers come through that are so clearly not from this level of consciousness. And so most of the information that I'll be sharing with you tonight comes from that other place. And some of it also comes from this place, from this human self, and how I interface with that other place. But I think, you know, I have no question that many of you in this room, in one way or another, are bringing through wisdom from places other than your personal self. And it's an incredibly cool thing to be able to do, even if it just happens in times when you're in conversation with a friend and, you know, you just say the exact right thing, you know, or, you know, if you practice any kind of art, you know, if you play music, if you write, if you paint or draw or dance, or if you're a scientist or an inventor, you know, it's one of the things that I talk about in the book, actually, is that this phenomenon of bringing something through from a larger place is something that people have been doing, you know, clearly for as long as there have been people, you know, and Einstein was doing it, and Carl Jung was doing it, and, you know, so I'm pretty sure that all of you in some way are doing it as well. And so what I really like to talk about is how, if you choose to, you can do that more. because I think for a lot of us, the phenomenon of getting in touch with that place of greater depth, you know, greater wisdom, greater spaciousness, you know, greater clarity, greater love, greater acceptance, is something that we stumble upon, you know, from time to time, but we don't really know how to cultivate deliberately. I think many people use meditation, the path of meditation, as a way to get closer to that place, and for some people that works. But I believe there are lots of other ways that can be even more direct. I think for me, writing poetry, actually, for a really long time, was my way of getting to that place. And I don't write much poetry anymore because I was using the poetry to get to that place of wisdom, and then I got more direct ways. So I'm glad I wrote all those poems, but now I do different things. And I think one of the things that's really essential is just for you all, for everyone, to know that this is possible for us as human beings. It's possible for us to get in touch with that kind of level of clarity and wisdom and depth, and to do it deliberately and purposefully as often as we want, and then to let it inform us. You know, at one point when I was, you know, sort of wrestling with, you know, why me? Why was I getting this information? You know, I was kind of shown this vision of, you know, all of this knowledge and wisdom just kind of resting right above us as if it were water, and wherever it finds an opening, it just kind of trickles through. So it's really just about, you know, if you want to be an opening, knowing that that's possible, and then finding the ways that you can facilitate that for yourself. So that's kind of one of my messages. You know, I guess the thing that I wrestle with a lot, and that I imagine that you may be wrestling with as well, and that's why I put it in the topic of the talk, is, you know, the on a troubled planet piece. Like, here we are, we're in this, you know, beautiful, progressive little community with this wonderful bookstore with, you know, the smell of incense and all these beautiful spiritual books around. But there is some really, really scary stuff happening out there all the time. And actually, a lot of times, there's some scary stuff happening in here, too, right? And so for me, it's that tension that is actually in some ways the most interesting. When I was primarily a poet, I worked for years as an AIDS educator, and so I was talking about, you know, sex and death all the time, and sex in the context of death. And then I was with a chronically ill partner to whom I donated a kidney, and that's what the memoir is about. And, you know, so again, there were those tensions. It was like, you know, this thing that's beautiful and this thing that's ending it all, or, you know, this thing that's beautiful and this thing that's terrible. That was always the place from which poetry came. And I think on a human level, we sometimes want to have it be just beautiful, you know, like let's get rid of the death, or let's get rid of the struggle. But in some way, you know, we're here in the whole mix, and we do know things by contrast. And, you know, Jon Kabat-Zinn, the mindfulness meditation teacher, calls it the full catastrophe. I love that phrase. You know, we're kind of here in the full catastrophe. And I think in some ways this is the most meaningful place in which to draw on that wisdom that we can. Because if we weren't in a place that was troubled, kind of, you know, why would we need it? We could just, you know, wander around and sit in the sun and eat chocolate every day, you know, or whatever your personal pleasures might be. So, you know, all these things that are happening, you know, I think we can focus on the things that are bad in our minds. We can focus on the things that are good. We can vacillate back and forth. The perspective that my guide offers is that we really, as human beings, can't know what is good or bad in the final analysis, because we are just too small to be able to know. You know, and some of you have probably heard that Buddhist story about the farmer. Is that the one you're thinking of? Okay, so the farmer, what is it? One day these wild horses run into the farmer's pasture, and, you know, all the townspeople say, "Oh, that's so good, you're so lucky," you know, and then the farmer's son is riding on one of the horses and falls and breaks his leg, and the townspeople say, "Oh, that's so bad, you're so unlucky." And then the military comes in and they gather up all the young men in the town, but they don't take the kid because his leg is broken. And then the townspeople say, "Oh, that's so good, you're so lucky," you know, and then on and on and on. And I think that's often what we do. And the image that my guide gave me, which I really like, is that when we as human beings try to understand the nature of reality, we're like a mouse trying to eat an alligator in one bite. You know, it's our jaws cannot open that wide, you know, and we can kind of scamper around on the alligator and, you know, take little nibbles here and there or glimpse things here and there. But we can't know the whole picture. You know, so something that I like to say is, I feel like, you know, if you know the story about the blind man and the elephant, and they're all describing, you know, the elephant is like a tree if they're touching the leg, or the elephant is like a rope if they're touching the tail. So I like to say, I feel like I have, you know, one finger on one hair at the tip of the elephant's tail, maybe, you know. And within that, you know, there are things that seem really problematic, and then there are things that seem really good, and then there is this whole vast tapestry being woven that I feel I'm playing a part in the weaving of, all of you are playing a part in the weaving of. And so to me, the question that's most interesting is, how can we show up in a way that feels meaningful and joyful to each of us, not ignoring the really challenging stuff that is happening on this planet, but also not being sort of wagged around by it, you know, like the tail wagging the dog. You know, how can we find a deep enough center, you know, sort of abiding principles within ourselves to be able to confront what's going on outside and inside. And so again, that's why I am an advocate for, you know, all of the practices that we can do ourselves to get in touch with that more spacious, more abiding wisdom. Which doesn't, by the way, say to do nothing. But it out of that, in my experience anyway, comes action which is really congruent and aligned with something deep, as opposed to action which is frenetic or frantic. Is this making any sense? So does anybody have any questions or comments at this point?
I just wondered if the book encouraged or had any words or chapters on learning how to
Yes, absolutely. It does. Yeah, there's a lot of that. There's a chapter called Connecting with Higher Consciousness. There are a bunch of specific practices that I offer, but it's also not an orthodoxy. It's not, you know, do this way. It's an offering. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an invitation. But absolutely, it talks about, as I was saying earlier, all of the ways that so many of us are already connected with that level of reality, what shamans call non-ordinary or non-physical reality. You know, I've always found that if we start having conversations, you know, sometimes people have these conversations, you know, late at night after a few glasses of wine or whatever, but people start talking about all the psychic phenomena they've experienced, like all the things that they've known that they weren't supposed to be able to know. And pretty much everybody has those stories, you know, even the skeptics, like if you know, you really get them talking. So that's part of what I try to do in the book, is demystify the concept. So it's not like, you know, you are going to arrive on a throne and be, you know, swathed in purple silk and start, you know, speaking to God. I mean, it might happen that way, but, you know, for most of us, probably not. But just that there are already openings. We're already permeable. And so, again, there are lots of practices that you can use to just increase that permeability in a deliberate way.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Who was the shamanic practitioner you worked with?
Her name is Isa Guicciardi, and she teaches in Berkeley mostly. She has a organization called the Foundation of the Sacred Stream. And she was a great teacher for me. But, you know, as it sounds like you might know, since you know about shamanic practitioners, that's the name for them. You know, part of what shamanism is a process of connecting with inner teachers. So she was my human teacher. She was kind of the one that pointed to the door and said, you can go through this. But then when you go through the door, then you get access to many teachings that come through your own channels and filters. Yeah. And, you know, even talking about shamanism, sometimes I hesitate because to me, shamanism is just a way of acknowledging that this physical level of reality is not the only reality, you know. And shamans, you know, that's a contemporary word. It came from a specific culture that now we're using more widely. It's a contemporary way of acknowledging the phenomenon. And some people really resonate with that word, and, you know, some people don't. And so for me, what's more important even than talking about shamanism is talking about the fact that this is an aspect of reality that people have sensed for as long, as far as we can tell, for as long as there have been people. You know, there have been ways of working with the unseen, understanding the unseen, understanding that this physical reality is not the only thing that's real. So, I mean, I love shamanic practices, particularly core shamanism, which is what I studied, which is not the shamanic tradition of any one part of the world. It's kind of the core elements that have been synthesized by a particular anthropologist named Michael Harner. But for me, I would hate to say that the book is about shamanism. It's really about all of us. So I guess I'll talk a little bit more and then see what other questions that brings up for people. You know, I feel like in our lives we are constantly making choices, right? And we're very aware of the big choices that we make, and if you're anything like me, you maybe sort of agonize over them sometimes, like, you know, what kind of work to do and where to live and what person to be with and, you know, what is going to be exactly right and, you know, well, this is right in all these ways, but maybe not a perfect fit here. And, you know, so there's those big choices. And then there are the, you know, hundreds and hundreds of small choices that we make every day in terms of, you know, just our internal monologues, how we think and what we think about what we think, you know, how we engage with other people, you know, what we choose to turn our attention to and to turn our attention away from. And a lot of us have a tremendous amount of freedom in those choices, but having the amount of freedom that we have can actually be kind of overwhelming. I think a lot of us can experience that there can be too many choices and we're not sure on what basis to choose. Especially because most of us are kind of complex amalgams and we've got, you know, ourselves and our own inclinations, essential inclinations, but then we've got all these overlays of, you know, our family and our family wounding and our culture and our little subcultures and our, you know, so it's like, well, if I'm operating from this place, I might choose this, but if I'm operating from this place, I might choose that. And so one of the things that I love that my guide has taught me is that the best basis from which to choose is joy. And there's a phrase that he uses, which is, joy is our best navigational aid. And he describes joy as being a feeling that comes to us as human beings, but it really comes through us from a deeper place in us. It comes from the soul. So it's different in that sense than pleasure or contentment. You know, like if we're choosing on the basis of pleasure, you know, that's fine, but we can't always choose on the basis of pleasure, because sometimes we think we're going for pleasure and we get displeasure in response, right? Like we order one thing from the menu and we find that what comes is not what we like after all. Choosing from joy is a different kind of process, according to my guide, because it's really tapping into a deeper place within us. And he also gives the idea that we each have an inner blueprint, which is kind of our soul's purpose, and our purpose in each life is to fulfill our inner design. And we know when we're fulfilling it because we feel joy. And when we don't feel joy, we're either doing something that's out of alignment with the blueprint, or it might even be in alignment, but we might be doing it for the wrong reasons. You know, doing it with the wrong energies. And I can use myself as an example. You know, I'm a healer and, you know, a hypnotherapist and shamanic practitioner. And I've kind of been a sort of healer type all my life. You know, I'm probably not alone in this room in that. You know, I grew up trying to help my family in their pain and struggles. And, you know, people always just sort of came to me and talked to me. And for a really long time, I tried really hard to help people, but not in the right way. And right, you know, makes it sound like there's right and wrong. And I guess what I would really say is not in a way that was congruent with my spirit, you know, not in a way that brought me joy, because I was trying to help people from a place of feeling frantic about how much pain they were in, feeling like this experience that they're having is wrong, this shouldn't be happening, or this experience of discomfort I'm having about their discomfort is wrong, I don't want to be having it, so I better try and help them. And so as I'm fulfilling my inner design, there is a different way that I have, not that I'm perfect at, but that I, you know, sometimes am able to encounter, where it's much more effortless. It's just a way of being. I have something to offer. It feels good to offer it. The person may be able to take it and make use of it. They may not. Either way, I'm fulfilling my inner design by offering it. So that's an example of a way to navigate by joy. Now, if I decided I'm sick of being a therapist, I don't want to do that anymore, I want to do something else, that would be fine too. You know, because my inner design isn't, none of our inner designs from what this guide says are dependent on a specific form. We all have multiple different forms in which we can express our inner design. But again, the thing that keeps it simple is the idea of navigating by joy. Noticing where we feel joy and gravitating toward that. Yeah?
Could you sort of define joy to distinguish it from pleasure and fun and those, I guess, shallower or hedonistic things?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, it's so, our language is so binary. It's so hard to talk about these things without making it sound like some things are better than others. So I don't want to make it sound like joy is better than pleasure or contentment, but I think my experience is that joy is more encompassing. So I can feel joy even while I'm feeling sorrow. I can feel joy even if I'm really tired and I'm doing something that I don't, you know, the human part of me doesn't really feel like doing in that moment. There can still be a kind of a joy that infuses it. Whereas in my experience of pleasure, it is more one-dimensional. Not that that's bad, but it's just like, you know, sitting in the sun eating chocolate is really fun. If it starts raining, it's not so fun anymore. You know, that feels more like pleasure. Whereas joy can be, you know, let's say sitting at the bedside of somebody who's dying and having, you know, intense grief, but also intense feeling of rightness in that contact at the same time. That might be one way to define it. It's more capacious. It holds more. Does that fit for you?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
When my mother died, I witnessed her cremation. I turned on the gas. I looked in the record and everything, and I felt this sense of joy. And I didn't quite know how to describe it. I did use the word joy.
Wow.
And it was like a feeling of rightness. It was like really intense, and it wasn't happy in a sense, and yet it felt so right to be there doing that. And the word that came to mind was joy.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for sharing that. That was a perfect little exchange there.
Did you like your mother?
No, that would not have been joy. If he had not liked his mother, that might have been glee or vengeance. but not quite joy.
So staying with the joy a minute, and your example of the sun, sitting in the sun and eating chocolate, is there some joy that can come out of that? I mean, my thought would be a deep appreciation for the sun.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just trying to get some sense of, well, what would be joy in that situation?
This is it's a really great question. And I guess what's coming to me is that joy is a state which is less subject to the fluctuations in outer conditions. So that in that example, sitting in the sun eating chocolate, yes, you could have joy in appreciating the sun. And if it started to rain, if you were then able to transfer your joy into the, oh my God, isn't this rain amazing? Then it would, I think, have made that transition from pleasure more to joy.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It sounds like you're talking about connection. So, you know, it sounds like that's what the difference between just pleasure, you know, joy seems like more of a connection with other things. Like when you're connecting with somebody who's dying or whatnot, there's an essence of that because of the connection, not because of the superficial that's...
Yeah, maybe it's about that. I mean, I think it's kind of up to each of us to feel into what brings joy up for us, and maybe it is connection for many of us, or maybe even all of us, I don't really know. But I think it is that feeling of rightness that you were describing, whatever brings that about. And it might be a solitary connection, you know, it might be, you know, a deep connection with a tree or a plant or an animal or, you know, the sky, the all that is. You know, or it might be, you know, some people I think we're made in such a way that it is very much about relationality with other people. Yeah.
Could I just say, for me, I think I have problems with the word feel. And for me, it's a knowing.
Uh-huh.
And it'll take me by surprise that I'm not expecting. As you said, a tree, I went into the redwood forest the other day and I was just riveted, and that to me was a knowing joy that I had no idea I was going to experience.
Uh-huh, uh-huh, wow.
That's
beautiful.
That's how I...
And so the distinction between feeling the joy and knowing it for you was, how would you describe that?
Well, because I'm working with feeling.
Uh-huh.
My own particular issue is feeling.
Uh-huh.
So...
The idea that you feel too much or not enough.
Or just that actual word.
Uh-huh.
So for me, when it takes me by surprise like that, it, for me, that I look on that as joy.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I mean, and that makes me think too of joy as being kind of a full body experience.
Yes, when
rather
you
than
connected to the soul, it's just there.
Yeah.
So I can't orchestrate it; it just happens.
Yeah, yeah, that's beautiful. I think that's another aspect of joy, actually, is that we can't orchestrate it.
Mm.
You know, like you can go on the, like I said, you can choose the item from the menu, or you can go on the vacation and be in the beautiful place, but you have no control over whether you'll feel joy. It comes, or
yes.
It doesn't.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's just my own personal.
Yeah, yeah. I love this, because this is kind of like a group process of defining exactly what joy is, and I think that that's the best way to do it, is to identify how you have known it or experienced it. It's got its signature for you. Yeah, and you had a question.
Well, I was just going to say that Course in Miracles distinguishes joy from happiness by saying that happiness is dependent upon outer circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
Even something as beautiful as redwood trees, it's still dependent on outer circumstances. Whereas joy has nothing to do with what's happening externally. It comes from deep within our being. It comes from that internal place, that inner Buddha kind of place,
mm-hmm.
where no matter what's happening externally in the world, when you can find and tap into that that place, that joy can be there regardless of what's happening in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Accessing that is a whole
other. I was going to ask, have you found that to be true?
Well,
for yourself?
I studied Course in Miracles in a group for about 4 or 5 years, and I did have moments, because we would meditate in the group,
mm-hmm.
and I did have long extended periods of time where no matter what was happening externally,
mm-hmm.
that I was really tapped into that inner peace, that inner joy,
mm-hmm.
and it's almost like just a gratitude for existing,
mm-hmm.
just a gratitude
mm-hmm.
for being,
mm-hmm.
no matter what we're experiencing.
You just took the words right out of my head, because that's where I was going to go after you were done this. That's how, for me, where I found joy was coming from a place of gratitude everywhere,
mm-hmm.
everything I
mm-hmm.
come to is trying to be grateful and have gratitude for everything in my life.
No matter
and that
how
brings
hard
up
it is,
the joy,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
right? Whether it's a death, it's anything. Having gratitude for being there and having the experience,
right,
and being able to be a part of
right.
it, yeah,
right, and holding on to that all the time through really hard times is not that easy. But
right.
I've had periods where I was riding that wave
yeah.
of joy, and no matter what was
yeah.
happening. And then sometimes, you know, the tidal wave takes me under, and I go tumbling.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to, because the subject came up, and,
mm-hmm.
and that was. I'm not saying that A Course in Miracles is the ultimate authority, but
mm-hmm.
It gave me a definition
mm-hmm.
Distinguishing between happiness and joy.
Mm-hmm.
And it did help me to kind of go deeper and tap into that gratitude of being.
And it's interesting. I mean, I think language itself is problematic, because, you know, language is like pinning the butterfly to the wall rather than watch it fly around. And we all have slightly different associations and connotations, perhaps, with each word. But I think the state of joy that I'm talking about here is a state that I don't know that it can be sustained all the time, but that it is a state. So it has some relationship to what we're doing, and that's how we can navigate by it. Because what brings me joy is probably not the same as what brings you joy. So it's a particular way of engaging. It's like treating that sense that some of you were talking about as a signal from the inner GPS. You know, it's like this is the right direction for you at this moment in time. So I think that's a little bit different than, although I love, you know, that truth, that we can reach a place where no matter what happens, everything is okay. It's a slightly different flavor than something that we can navigate by, because in that experience, anything is the same as anything else. Is that what I'm at least hearing? Is that true?
I'm thinking it's more a matter of what you were saying before about connecting.
Uh-huh.
Being able to acknowledge that all things are here out of love and light, and that we can connect to them on an energy level, and that can bring you joy, knowing that you're not
mm-hmm.
alone, that all these things are connected
mm-hmm.
to you and
mm-hmm.
to them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, there is an incredible interconnectedness and synergy in life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that is joyful to
yeah.
to contemplate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, at least in the teaching that's in this book, there is an understanding that each of us has forms that feel more right to us. You know, like, it's not that it's better or worse to be married or single, you know, living in the city or the country, doing this kind of work or that kind of work, having kids or not having kids, but each of us has, you know, ways of life that will bring us more joy, and that that is a deeply aligned thing to follow, to listen to, and to follow. And that most of us have a lot of crap in the way of being able to listen to that and follow that. So that's kind of the next piece that I talk about a lot in the book, because most of us, you know, have been subject to cultural ideas that maybe, you know, that would be a self-indulgent way to live. Like, who are we to do what makes us happy? You know, that, you know, or sacrifice is better, you know, or that we don't deserve X, Y, Z, or, you know, all of those sorts of things. And so very often we have some things to clear out before we can really listen and respond to our inner design, to what brings joy. Does this feel true to anybody? So one of the things that I really love about the branch of shamanism that I studied, core shamanism, is the understanding that there are only three causes to all of the imbalances that we experience. And by imbalance, it could be anything from, you know, physical disease to depression to anxiety to, you know, beliefs that I don't deserve to, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And the three causes are soul loss, which is defined as, you know, something that happens to us in times of trauma, that part of us actually splits off to let us bear, help us bear the trauma. Power loss, which is somewhat similar, times when our power gets repeatedly taken away. And energetic interference, which is, or when our energetic integrity gets compromised. And what is even better than the idea that there are just three causes is the understanding that all of them have remedies. So soul loss is remedied by soul retrieval, power loss is remedied by power retrieval, and compromised energetic integrity is remedied by restoring the right boundaries, getting other people's energy and stuff out, and restoring ourselves to ourselves. And so this is a, you know, very brief description of that, but this is, there's much more information about all of that in the book. And, you know, I said for a long time I've been a healer, and I think at this point, in a way, I'm somewhat less interested in the work of healing, but I'm really interested in what we can get to when we, the more of that healing we've done, you know. So it's not about getting all caught up in the trauma, it's realizing that there are actually ways out of it and through it. And then we get to play, you know, then we get to follow what brings us joy, you know, the things that we're deeply aligned with so much less interference internally. And then that, from there, is kind of how I get to get back to this idea of the troubled planet. You know, if we are each really living from a place of you know, deep connection to ourselves and joy, which by the way, I do suspect that it also corresponds with deep connection to other people or other beings in some way, the planet changes.
We're all things.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Our experience changes. And, you know, like the story about the 100 monkeys, you know, I really believe that the more that each of us, we're each a microcosm, and, you know, each of the pressures that we feel inside, you know, the pressures toward judgment, the pressures toward, you know, greed or corruption or stinginess with ourselves or with others or harshness or all of this stuff. It's not that we have to become better people. You know, I mean, it's not that Christian idea that, you know, we'd better do this or we go to hell. It's kind of like, if we don't do it, we're in hell right now. You know, and if the more that we clear that stuff out, the more we're in heaven right now. You know, and so my guide always says, like, all the shoulds, and, you know, I should do this more often, I should do that more often, like, you know, this is better, this is more evolved, this is the way to be a more conscious human being, whatever. It's like, from the information I get here, it's like, you know, forget all of that. Just say, what brings me joy? And there's no shoulds, you know, there's just the opening. There's the possibility of moving in the direction that brings you joy. And I don't know, I love the simplicity of that. Not that it's easy, but that it's simple. Other questions or comments?
Well, I was just reflecting that, you know, sort of the paradigm that I was brought up with, and I suspect others too, was what would bring me more security.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, it wasn't too long ago a friend said, well, you know, I always ask myself, what would bring me more peace?
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that was something that I contemplated. And then tonight, you know, you suggested what would bring me more joy. So it is sort of another level of expansion,
mm-hmm.
to sort of claim that for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a beautiful way to put it. Yeah, thank you. And that's also a perfect example of how most of us have these different paradigms jostling around inside of us. Like, you know, and absolutely for many of us, security or safety is one of the paradigms. And it's up to each of us, obviously, which paradigms we want to consciously choose to navigate by. But when we don't consciously choose, we tend to navigate kind of by default with all the stuff that got in there that we may not even consciously agree with, but it's just kind of running us from underneath. So there is a lot in the book about the power of intention and prayer. I love prayer. Now, some people don't resonate with the word prayer because they had traumatic, you know, religious childhoods. And you can substitute the word prayer with, you know, just contacting what's larger, however you understand that, and asking for help. But it is very much about, you know, setting intention, making deliberate choices, like, and then asking for help from whatever is larger, like, help me navigate more by joy, help me clear out the structures in my being that, you know, constrict around security and keep me from joy. You know, or whatever it is that you choose.
Yeah, reminder of Carlos Castaneda books where Don Juan tells him to follow a path that has heart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Many paths to take, follow one that has heart for you.
Yeah, yeah. I love that quote because he actually says all paths lead nowhere. So the only question to ask is, does this path have a heart?
Very encouraging.
Well. Yeah. I mean, there's the sense that in a way it doesn't matter. I mean, that's the information that I've gotten with my own personal quandaries that I have, believe me, asked this guide about over and over and over. You know, and sometimes I get at a certain point the feeling that, you know, when I'm saying, well, should I do this or should I do that? Should I take that job? Should I live in this house or that one? You know, all of that. From my guide's perspective, it's like being in the Mexican restaurant saying, should I have the taco or the burrito or the enchilada? You know, it's like, it doesn't really matter, you know? But what matters is the basis on which we're making the choice. Because, like, if I really want the taco, but I'm denying myself the taco, that's a problem. But other than that, it doesn't matter when I have the taco or the burrito or the enchilada, you know? Like, and it doesn't matter if I live in this place or this place or this place or am with this person or do this kind of work. If the navigating principle, you know, and the energy that's moving through it is joy and a willingness to follow that. Yeah.
So you mentioned, and then the advertisement for tonight had something to do with purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And would you make that bridge for us? Talk about it.
Yeah, thank you.
Purpose in this troubled world.
Yeah. So what, again, you know, I just keep referring to my guide because it doesn't feel authentic to say, this is what I think, you know. This is what I've been taught by this non-physical being, is that each of us has one purpose, which is to become most fully ourselves. And, you know, so if you look at a little dandelion plant, it's very clear, like, its purpose is to be a dandelion, right? And it doesn't matter if it's growing in a lush green lawn or, you know, a harsh desert or on a mountaintop. Like, if it possibly can, it's going to become a dandelion. And maybe it's going to become a scraggly little dandelion, or maybe it's going to become like a big lush dandelion. But it's clear, like, its purpose is to become a dandelion. And so each of our purpose is to become the fullest expression of what we are, who we are. And guess how we figure out what that is? Exactly. I mean, so it sounds so simple, it's almost moronic, and yet it's not. It's right on that borderline between moronic and deep, but I hope it's deep. You know, because, maybe somebody in the group has an example, otherwise I'll try and come up with examples from my own life. Yeah.
I'm just thinking of the popular Jewish story of Susa, just before he was dying.
Mm-hmm.
He seemed kind of worried, and someone asked him, what are you worried about? Is it you're afraid God's going to think you didn't become like Moses? And he says, no, I'm worried that God's going to be worried that I didn't become more like Susa.
Oh, perfect. Yeah. Perfect. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, because that's a wonderful confirmation of the same principle.
Yeah, I just put that story on my new blog.
Oh, wonderful. That's great. Yeah. Yeah. So what is it to become like John Amadeo, you know, or what is it to become like, you know, whoever each of you is? I mean, that's such a dynamic question, you know. It's not a static question, because it's in each moment.
There's so much to choose. Deciding. There's so many choices internally.
Right. And you know, if you're lucky, there are lots of choices that can bring joy, you know, and in that case, it doesn't matter. You just do one of them. But, you know, there's...
Just one?
Well, no, and then you do another. Or if you can, you know, do the equivalent of walking and chewing gum at the same time, you get to do multiple things that bring joy at once. But we are, you know, on the human level, we are bounded by these physical bodies. You know, so even though this physical reality is not all that there is, you know, I at least can imagine, like, you know, 1,000 different lives, and I have done a lot of different things and lived in a lot of different places in one life, but I don't get to have 1,000 lives in one, you know. So that's where some of the choice comes in.
Well, this is reminding me of, you know, the Delphic Oracle said to Socrates, know thyself.
Mm-hmm.
And this idea of joy, the way you're talking about it, it seems almost like a tautology, that it's bound up with this idea of self-knowledge, at least the way I understand it, that you can't, that it's almost like joy and self-knowledge are two sides of the same coin.
Mm.
And you can't have a clear understanding of joy or what is joy to you without a requisite amount or degree of self-knowledge. And so these two things seem to be constantly cycling back and forth between one another. So it's almost like your sense of joy also evolves along with your understanding of yourself and your understanding of the reality that you're operating in, or however you want. Describe it. But that's why I think it's so hard for a lot of us to ascertain this joy, because it's tied up with self-knowledge. And self-knowledge is a thing that isn't always clear. It's something that sort of has a certain...
I think what concerns me about what you're saying is that it sounds a little heady, and it's this idea that we can't know what brings us joy until we know ourselves, and how are we going to get the self-knowledge? And my actual sense from, you know, my own experience and what several people in the room have said tonight is that You know, you didn't know that redwood tree was going to bring you joy, and you certainly didn't know that cremating your mother was going to bring you joy. You know, so, I mean, in a sense, there is self-knowledge that comes in that moment. There's self-discovery, but it's not a cognitive thing. I mean, the cognitive catches up later. It's like, oh, wow, I felt that in that circumstance.
Yeah, but terms of orienting your life towards something, I mean, that would be like sort of a temporary experience. But for somebody to think about their life in a more overarching sense.
Well, you have to have the ability to notice what you feel when you feel it. I think that's true. But I think most of us do tend to catalog these experiences. I mean, when you felt joy, I would suspect, you know, if each of you were to name, you know, several times that you felt joy, you could do it. Right?
I mean, probably want to repeat those experiences.
right, because they're experiences that get your attention. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think it doesn't even have to be a cognitive process of, well, I felt joy then, and I felt joy then, so that means this. It's, I mean, I guess maybe it could be, but I think it's also more of a, you know, if I go in this direction, is this bringing more of that feeling or less of that feeling? You know, I think it's that there is a more visceral sort of intuitive process, at least for me, than what you're describing.
That is a kind of self-knowledge, though. I think what you're saying is a kind of self-knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Not an intellectual knowledge.
Yeah.
It's kind of like awakening to something.
Yeah.
And being able to notice.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I'm not referring
yeah.
to a cognitive process per se. I'm referring more to like developing like a deep sense of intuition.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
And I think it's also involves just paying attention to ourselves. Treating the experiences of joy that we have as significant rather than insignificant, you know, because like, I don't know, in the paradigm of security that you were brought up in, I'm guessing that, you know, at least for a lot of people, it's like, well, if you have a good time, that's nice, but that's not what life's about. Mm-hmm. It's about this other thing, you know.
And even with joy, if that's a navigational tool for myself, you know, sometimes it can be, you know, joy sometimes implies this, you know, huge experience, but a lot of times I'm, you know, out in my yard and I just, you know, after about an hour, I feel like a different person.
Yeah.
Just, you know, puttering around and gardening.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe harvesting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, and so in some ways it's sort of subtle, but I've taken the time to notice, wow, this always picks my energy up and I always feel more connected.
Uh-huh, yeah, yeah, that's wonderful.
It's like an equanimity. Like,
yeah.
Like an equanimous sense of well-being. Mm-hmm. is what I get.
Right. And then hopefully, it sounds like you do, you know, hopefully we have a clear enough relationship with ourselves that when we notice what brings us joy, we do more of it.
Well, most of the time.
Right. Yeah.
Just the right amount.
And what is that right amount?
Yeah. It changes.
Especially in a drought year.
Yeah. And, you know, and this connects up with, you know, I think the last thing I said on the flyer about that by working in this way, we actually are impacting the world, you know. And I love the studies. I'm sure many of you are familiar with things like, you know, when a higher number of people in Washington, D.C. started meditating, the crime rate went down, you know, those sorts of things. Or when somebody gets prayed for, you know, even though nobody knows who's getting prayed for, they get better faster. You know, so these little bits of scientific evidence that we're getting that the state of consciousness that we hold actually makes a difference. And so even if it's just you in your garden, if you're holding that state of, you know, peace and relaxation, that actually can make a difference to the world. I love that idea. Because then that's where we aren't forced to choose. You know, so many of the paradigms that I think we were, you know, inculcated in were the idea of like, well, you can do the right thing or you can feel good, but, you know, it's not going to be both.
Good point.
So, yeah, so other questions or comments, yeah.
I think for me, my experiences of joy have come as some kind of grace, unexpectedly.
Yeah, yeah.
And always there's the tendency that I have to try to repeat, but that turns it into kind of a mechanistic expectation. That doesn't work for me.
I don't think it works for anybody. And I think that's exactly why, you know, in this teaching, why joy is a reliable navigational aid. Because if it were replicable, you know, if it were like, well, be in this place doing this thing with this person at this time and you will feel joy, that takes it out of the realm where it's this deep kind of contact with your soul, you know, and with the reality and with the moment. That takes it more like, okay, it is pleasurable every morning at 8 a.m. to have my cup of tea with this much half and half in it, you know, or whatever, but that's not joy. Yeah.
For me, it's been an experience like, it's not that I have joy, but it has me.
Yeah.
And I am subsumed within it somehow.
Yes. Yeah.
That's it. Shows up, it comes over you.
Yeah. 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 I love all of these ways of describing it because I think we all know what that state is, and we all have our own particular ways of experiencing it. Like you call it a knowing, and for you, joy has you, and, you know, each of the ways you've described it. And I agree that it's not, as I was saying to you, this kind of joy, in my experience, isn't something that we can have 100% of the time. But we can navigate by it. You know,
so... Let it nudge you.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And so it's not like, yes, I will make myself have joy again by doing exactly the same thing. It doesn't work. But at the same time, there is an intuition, or there is a growing body of self-knowledge. Maybe this goes back to what you were saying, where it's like, you know, this way of being feels good, or being in my garden brings joy, or working with people in this way, you know, or with this friend, the conversations that we tend to have, you know. Not that you can guarantee it, but that, you know, it, in that milieu, it tends to open up.
Might also contrast it with having fun.
Uh-huh.
To use that expression, let's go out and have some fun. It's,
mm-hmm.
To them, it's some kind of a discharge or something, a release or something.
Huh.
It's not
uh-huh.
necessarily a deep sense of well-being that they're
mm-hmm.
sitting in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people, you know, we haven't been taught as a culture to pay attention to this. And so I do think people are accepting cheap substitutes for it because they don't know what else is out there. You know, I remember at one point on Meetup when I lived in Oakland, I had this idea. I was organizing what I called deep dinner parties, and the idea was that all these strangers would come together and have a dinner party at my house and talk about deep things. And, you know, so I was going around asking people what brought them joy, and this guy was like, well, lots of things bring me joy. Barbecued potato chips bring me joy, you know. And I don't think he was quite talking on the level that we've been talking tonight, you know. And so what that made me realize was that, you know, we don't have very much education because it's not something we've been taught to pay attention to. You know, most of us have reams of knowledge about, like, which kind of car is the most expensive and confers the most status, you know, but we don't have a lot of information about what joy is. Yeah.
And I would, from my own perspective, it's not that, not only do we not have information, there's not value placed on it. We're taught other things that are
yeah.
much more important. Work hard, earn money. You know, I don't know.
Right, that's the security thing, yeah.
So, you know, the whole value of joy. In fact, somewhere I think we learned that you're not supposed to be joyful. You know, you're not. I mean, that's out there somewhere, you
mm-hmm.
know, that you're not.
Mm-hmm.
Right,
yeah.
Because other people are suffering somewhere.
Yeah, so
and you
how
should suffer
how
for
can
them, too.
You know, mm-hmm. that's the thing of, you know, it being not valued.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. And so, you know, again, when you get back to this troubled earth and what can each of us do you know, I mean, there are so many things that we cannot affect or control, and then there is a sphere that we can affect, maybe not control, but that we can deeply affect, and that is this little sphere, you know, this little body, heart, mind that we're walking around in. And so part of the way I think we can do that is by making a conscious choice of what values and paradigms we want to navigate by in our lives. Because like I said earlier, when we don't choose consciously, we're run from underneath by all this old stuff and all of this conflicting stuff, you know.
I think even sometimes when we do choose consciously, at least this is my experience, I choose things consciously and I still find this undercurrent of old energies that are not on a conscious level, and they still seem to be throwing me around.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. So thank you for bringing that up. And that's a big part of what I talk about in the chapter on intention and prayer around having stuff that we need to clear out. Because just because I'm consciously saying I choose love and joy, you know, if I've got all of this unconscious matter, you know, built up, it's like I've got one foot on the gas and one foot on the brake.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. And that's a very stuck place to be.
Yeah, yeah. But we can, by making a choice to change it, we can change it. It takes some time and some effort. You know, there's a story that I tell in here, actually. You know, one of the chapters in the book is about saying yes to life, which, you know, on one hand, like, we're all physically alive, right? So on some level, I guess we've said yes to life. But, you know, a lot of people are walking around with a lot of argument about the conditions of this life. And that was true of me for a very long time, and, you know, sometimes still is, but I've made it a really conscious practice to say yes to life. And when I first decided that I wanted to do that, part of it was because my guides were very clear with me. Like, as long as I'm not doing that, it is like one foot on the gas and one foot on the brake. Like, we impoverish ourselves. We can't really live out our full life when part of us is busy saying no to it, busy arguing with it, you know. And so when I first made this decision, like, okay, I want to say yes to life as it is, you know, maybe 60% of me, or, you know, 55% of me wanted to, and, you know, the other substantial percentage didn't. And so then I used some of these tools that I talk about, like intention and prayer. It's like, help me move in this direction. Help me clear out and heal and release those parts that want to say no. You know, so absolutely what you bring up is really important, and there are ways to work with it.
Do you personally practice the soul retrieval? And
oh, absolutely, yeah.
For yourself, and also do you...
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah,
oh.
Yeah. I mean, I've been a practitioner of this kind of work, the heart-mind integration, as Rob said in my introduction. So, yeah, I do help other people with that process, and I do practice it myself. Yeah.
Well, you just talked about saying yes to life, but that kind of hit me a few months back when I realized I was doing the one foot on the gas and one foot on the brake, and I knew I needed to open that door up and change that. And I happened on this TED talk, and I don't know if anybody else has seen it, but I don't remember the lady's name that gave it, but she was really good, and she said, I want everybody to stand up and do this. Yes. And so now I do that for myself.
Wow.
Every once in a while, just to remind myself that yes, I'm open to life. And it opens you up. And you take a deep breath, you feel really good, and you're saying yes. And that's a positive thing.
Wonderful.
So,
and have you felt that making a difference?
Yeah, it really does. It makes you feel open. It makes you feel like, hey, okay, I'm open, I'm ready for something to come my way.
Yeah.
It's empowering.
Yeah, that's great.
And I share that since it really helped me, and I thought it was a nice thing to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
I share it with my patients all the time.
Uh-huh.
You know that.
Because a lot of them are stuck, especially a lot of the cancer patients are stuck in something in life. They're angry.
Right.
They're upset.
Right.
There's something not going right, and they're doing that.
Yeah.
One foot on the gas and one foot on the brake.
And so what I think is challenging there is that sometimes we can get that to move just by saying yes like this.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes there's, like you're saying, a whole lot of anger, a whole lot of grief, a whole lot of bitterness, other stuff that we need to... heal and release. Right, because otherwise people feel like, oh, I'm just pasting on this happy face, you know, and when it's that, then it doesn't really work.
Right.
Then it doesn't bring joy.
Right.
So again, that's the way you can talk.
Well, on the other hand, it does work, because it's another TED Talk by Amy Cuddy, who's a neuropsychologist.
Uh-huh.
And she talks about the same gesture. Have you seen
power poses.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
And she talks about your posture will actually create chemicals in your body.
Mm-hmm.
And those chemicals clearly make you feel differently. And
yeah.
I use it with my participants all the time.
Yeah.
If your body is part of all of this.
That's absolutely true.
As you manage your posture, you can manage how you are. What chemicals are going on in your body? Then.
There is a lot of interweaving. It's true. Absolutely. I mean, you can get to things through the body. You can get to things through the mind, through the spirit, through the, you know, lots of different ways.
Yeah.
And actually, as you said that, I just did 8 days of training with Gay and Katie Hendricks, who some of you might know of. Yeah, and they are very opposed to sitting. They do not have chairs in their house. They say that sitting is like worse for us than smoking. And I sat through the whole 8 days of the training on one of those big balls. And it's amazing how much better I felt. So, you know, absolutely, I concur. And, you know, since it brought me joy, you know, now I have a ball at home. So I'm realizing that I think it's the time that we're supposed to end, huh? So this has been really wonderful. Thank you so much for being here and for engaging. And I'm delighted to talk to any of you afterward once we formally close. And thank you so much for having me here.
And thank you so much for coming to Many Rivers. And thank you all for coming tonight. We have two customs that I want to apprise you of. There's a donation bowl over on the counter. We encourage you to contribute to it, and we share the proceeds with our speakers to further their work, and also retain half to help maintain this space for future such events. And we also encourage people to come over here and check out these books, the one that was whose work was discussed tonight, but also the other ones as well. And I dare say that Ruth would be happy to sign and or inscribe a personal message to anyone who would be so interested, so please do that. And please do come back and visit us again at one of our other events. Thank you again.
Thank you.